Hello, this is Elton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We begin this week's reading of the Triangle Business Journal on the biz page, as usual, and we find about five or six little articles here. And under the heading of Looking Better comes the article, Positive Trends for Hotels. The pandemic isn't over yet, but America's yearning to travel after a year in quarantine is starting to show some promise for the battered hotel industry. In Wake County, the occupancy rate for hotels for the week of March 28th to April 3rd was 52.6%, according to the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. That's well below the 70% mark hotels would often see this time of year, but better than the occupancy rate of 24.4% the county's hotel saw at one point last year. Occupancy rates, of course, are a critical economic indicator. Hotel occupancy delivered $2.1 million in tax revenue for Wake County in February of 2020, but only $1.1 million in February of 2021. And under the heading of Speakers, the article, More Big Names at Commencements. Graduation just wasn't the same a year ago, but this year, the area's colleges are holding commencements with an impressive array of speakers. Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Kismekia Corbett will speak at UNC Chapel Hill. Russell Wilson will speak at NC State University, and John Legend will speak at Duke University. And William Peace University will have a pair of well-known members of the business community speak when it holds commencement exercises for the class of 2020 on May 7th and class of 2021 on May 8th. Speaking to the class of 2020 is Mitchell Silver, who served as Raleigh's city planner before heading to New York City as commissioner of the Department of Parks and Recreation. He is returning to the Triangle to become a principal at McAdams. Bob Ingram will speak to Peace's class of 2021. Of course, he's the general partner at Hatteras Venture Partners, a driving force in the Triangle with its investments in early-stage life science companies. And under the heading of Gotta Be the Shoes, the article, Pricey Line Coming to North Carolina. If your high school daughter is squealing with joy in the other room, it may be that she just learned on TikTok that Golden Goose is coming to Charlotte. The Italian boutique plans to open in June at South Park. Golden Goose is known for sneakers with a big star and a distressed look, as well as a distressed look on parents when they see the $530 price tag. The brand was founded in 2000 by Venetian designers Francesco Rinaldi and Alessandro Gallo, and features leather jackets, jeans, and more in addition to the shoes. But if the sneakers and the $1,700 leather jackets will bust your budget, relax. A plain T-shirt is only $155. Under the heading of New Effort comes the article, Finding Raleigh's Hottest Locales. Raleigh is teaming up on a campaign to map the hottest parts of the city. The city has joined the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Association, Durham County, and others as volunteers with heat sensors. As volunteers with heat sensors will traverse their neighborhoods on one of the hottest days of the year. Within the same city, some neighborhoods can be 20 degrees hotter than others. And under the heading of Going Up comes the article, Pendo Lands Pizza Oven on the 19th Floor. Yes, you heard correctly, a pizza oven. Pendo employees gathered across the street recently to watch the ascension of a 9,000-pound pizza oven to the top floor of 301 Hillsborough, the future home of the tech firm. The oven will be one of the many amenities the company is incorporating into the new space. The 19th floor is the top floor of the tower and one of five that the company is leasing in the building. That floor will include a large patio space, a fire pit overlooking downtown, a coffee bar, a speakeasy, and an event space with bleacher seating in addition to the pizza oven. When we were designing the space, we were looking for things that are fun to do. And we're always looking to find ways to create a space where people want to come, Pendo founder Todd Olson says. And finally, on this week's biz page, under the heading of For Sale, comes the article, Grand Raleigh Home on Market. A large home on White Oak Road that has been the site of many Raleigh gatherings is on the market for $5.5 million. The 20,283 square foot home was built for the Daniels family, the former owners of the News and Observer, in 2000. The Daniels sold the In and Out to McClatchy for $373 million in 1995. Frank Daniels Jr., the longtime publisher of the paper, and his wife Julia hosted a wide variety of events at the home, with cars often strewn along White Oak Road near St. David's School. The parties included fundraisers for top Democratic candidates, events for Raleigh Hall of Fame inductees, and more. The home includes 6 bedrooms, 11 baths, and a grand spiral staircase. The home is on a lot that stretches from White Oak to Toxie Drive and is shrouded by trees, but it's actually one of the largest homes in the city. A home at 10761 Trago Trail, owned by Michael Allender, has 21,993 square feet. Among the area's other large homes includes the 18,300 square foot home once owned by Rich Lee, the founder of Hosted Solutions in North Raleigh, and the 16,047 square foot home of entrepreneur Robert Winston overlooking Carolina Country Club. Speck Underwood of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services is the listing agent for the Daniels home. Next, we turn the page to this week's finance and travel section in the Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of finances comes the article, Data Show CEO Salary Gap. For some Triangle CEOs, 2020 had them walking away with total compensation. It was hundreds of times more than the median compensation of their employees. Since 2018, publicly traded companies have been required to disclose how CEO compensation compares with that of median employees, and the differences can be stark, particularly at companies with large retail footprints. At Raleigh-based Advance Auto Parts, for example, CEO Tom Greco's nearly $8.1 million total compensation in 2020, which includes stock options and other bonuses, trumps the median employee pay of nearly $25,000 by a ratio of 3.23 to 1, filings show. At Durham-based Cree, CEO Greg Lowe made 136 times the total compensation of a median employee at the semiconductor maker. Industry watchers, however, say there aren't really surprises in these ratios, and that's because CEO pay was already disclosed in proxies prior to 2018. The CEO compensation numbers and ratio to average company compensation reflect a political issue more than an economic or business issue, says attorney Jim Verdonik of Innovate Capital Law in Raleigh. Also under in the finance and travel page, under the heading of pandemic side effect, Raleigh firm has plenty of jobs to fill and few applicants. Raleigh-based customer service outsourcing firm Customer HD is expanding in a big way. Just this past August, the technology firm, which is trying to make over the traditional call center, had about 90 people on staff. Today, the figure is at 250, and by June, the plan is to get to 350. But there's a problem, a big one. The company, which hires entry-level customer service representatives, is trying to lure applicants to job interviews with Starbucks gift cards. And even so, Schmidt estimates just 50% of those scheduled actually show up for video interviews. Ryan O'Donnell, CEO of Cary-based employee referrals software firm EmployUs, says that when it comes to in-person entry-level jobs, employers are having a lot of trouble filling the seats. It's been really difficult to get people back to work, O'Donnell says, noting restaurants and retail are having the same problem. And under the very short article of Triangle Financiers say it's a sizzling market for investors in pharma and tech, come statements from three of the founders of these companies. Art Pappas, who's the founder of Pappas Capital, his quote is, "Things have been going really well. Of course, the market has been favorable to the whole biotech sector." David Gardner, founder of tech-focused co-founders Capital and Cary, says, "Deal flow is great. Valuations are fair, and the ecosystem is humming." And Andy Schwab, co-founder of digital healthcare-focused investor Accelerate Health Ventures in Research Triangle Park, says he's seeing a tremendous amount of opportunities. And finally, under the heading of banking on this page of the finance and travel section, comes the article, J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo take different strategies in North Carolina. It's a tale of two big banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo. The former, a New York financial powerhouse, is executing a strategy to expand its branch network, aggressively entering new markets in places such as North Carolina. The latter is the biggest bank by deposits in the Triangle region, and it's looking to find efficiencies across its footprint, cutting both branches and staff. Jennifer Piepsack, Chief Financial Officer at J.P. Morgan, said on an earnings call this month that expanding the branch footprint continues to be a long-term play. Meanwhile, at Wells Fargo, some offices in the state have shuttered in recent weeks. The San Francisco-based bank is in the midst of efficiency initiatives on her branches, said CFO Mike Santomassimo on an earnings call. He said, "It's because transaction volume continues to shift away from our branches." Chris Marinac, Director of Research at Janney Montgomery Scott, said the noise at Wells Fargo under previous management caused it to lose the focus on cost controls at a time when the industry was getting more efficient. And next on our finance and travel page for this week's Triangle Business Journal, under the heading of aviation, comes the article, RDU puts emphasis on leisure travel as traffic ticks up. While leisure traffic is starting to trickle back to RDU International Airport, business travel, traditionally amounting to about 50% of RDU's passengers, is still at a near standstill. So as RDU works to win back air service, it's shifting its strategy. During the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority's April meeting, Kenneth Strickland, Director of Air Service at the airport, told the authority board that instead of trying to recruit business-heavy routes that aren't seeing traction, the airport should align its incentive program to reel in domestic routes related to leisure travel. RDU passed its latest air service incentives policy late last year. The program provides incentives in the form of landing fee waivers for new service to unserved airports and new service from carriers that are new to RDU. But the program, as initially written, required a six-month commitment for incentives. But as the pandemic drags on, we continue to see a substantial lag in business traffic, Strickland said. So instead of that six-month minimum, the board voted to institute a three-month minimum for both domestic and international service, aligning the policy to fit with seasonal leisure routes. And along with this very short prose comes a graph detailing the number of flights. And it says, travel plummeted at Raleigh-Durham International Airport when the pandemic hit in 2020, but as vaccines roll out, traffic is now picking back up. Here's a look at enplanements by month, going back to January of 2020. Now, I'll not read all of these. Obviously, the first one is January of 2020, and the number of people getting on a plane was 489,803. And it dropped very dramatically in March of that year and is starting to rebuild. And now in March of this year, the number is still about half of what it was in January of 2020. The number of enplanements March of 2021 is 251,404 persons. As we turn the page in this week's TBJ, we land on the real estate page. And under the heading of acquisition comes the article, Highwoods Buys Portfolio. A pair of high-profile office towers in Raleigh will change hands this year as part of a massive deal that will see Highwoods Properties buy a portfolio of high-end office properties in Raleigh, Charlotte, and Atlanta, with expectations for a total investment of nearly $769 million in the portfolio. On April 19th, Raleigh-based Highwoods, a real estate investment trust, announced an agreement with the Atlanta-based Preferred Apartment Communities. The agreement was to invest $769 million in the acquisition of a massive portfolio, including four Class A office towers in Raleigh and Charlotte, a mixed-use redevelopment site in Atlanta, and two non-core assets, including a mezzanine loan and a multi-building creative office project in Atlanta. The deal is expected to close in the third quarter of this year. Highwoods has already put up a $50 million non-refundable deposit. The aggregate purchase price for the portfolio is $717 million, according to Preferred Apartment Communities. Highwoods said its total investment, including the estimated value of the non-core assets, is expected to be $769 million, including $28 million of near-term building improvements and $5 million in transaction costs. In Raleigh, the portfolio includes the 29-story Wells Fargo Capital Center Tower at 150 Fayetteville in downtown Raleigh and the 16-story Cap Trust Tower, Highwood's first property in the coveted North Hills submarket. Other properties in the portfolio include Capitol Towers and Morrowcroft Center, both in Charlotte, as well as the Galleria 75, a mixed-use redevelopment site in Atlanta. Of the non-core assets, the mezzanine loan Highwoods will acquire is for a third party to construct 8 West, calling for a 195,000-square-foot, 9-story office building in Atlanta. The other non-core asset is Armor Yards, a multi-building creative office project also in Atlanta. According to the agreement, Preferred Apartment Communities will market Armor Yards for sale. If the company decides not to sell the property to another buyer, then Highwoods will acquire it no later than the first quarter of 2022. Highwoods plans to finance the purchase primarily through accelerating its planned sale of $500 million to $600 million in non-core assets in markets across the company's nationwide portfolio. Now we have three short articles under the heading of residential. Developer joins the rush to Briar Creek. A Durham-based developer is joining the rush to a booming area near Briar Creek with a rezoning request for its latest project, calling for up to 650 homes and apartments. Eden's Land Corporation recently filed plans for a new residential project in southeast Durham County, calling for up to 120 single-family detached homes, 300 townhomes, and up to 260 apartment units. The maximum number of apartments allowed would be 650. And under the heading of Hillsborough Street comes the article, Newest Raleigh Tower Nearly Complete. With all 19 stories in place and the large red crane and blue construction fencing set to come down soon, 301 Hillsborough in downtown Raleigh is gearing up to deliver later this year. But office tenants remain tough to lock down after a year of COVID-19 and remote work fueled uncertainty in the office market. Still, with several months left to go before tenants could move in, Fallon Company Managing Director Zach Van Cannon says delivery will come just in time to meet pent-up demand. Our timing is great to capitalize on the renewed sense of enthusiasm, he says. Across the triangle, office tenants have proved unwilling to commit to long-term leases, even as rising numbers of vaccinations provide some hope for a return to a kind of normal in the months ahead. And while some sectors have seen a corresponding surge, the office leasing market has been slow to bounce back. Currently, the tower has just one tenant confirmed, Raleigh tech firm Pendo, which has signed on to lease the top five floors for its new corporate headquarters, with plans to move in by the end of the year. And under the heading of housing comes the article Crunch, expected to continue. Housing market activity in the Triangle continued to boom last quarter, according to a recent report by Stacy Anfinson, as housing prices rose 12% from the same period last year. Meanwhile, inventory continues to plummet, as last month saw a 72% drop in inventory compared to the same time last year, even as sales activity continues to surge. And associated with this article is a small bar graph showing new listings and home closings for March of 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21. So the new listings in March, 4,223. That's March of 17. March of 18 is 3,965. 19, 3,780. 2020, 3,691. And finally in 2021, 3,447. So a steady decline from 4,223 new listings in March of 17 to 3,447 in 2021. Now for home closings, it starts at 2779 in March of 17, drops to 2665 in 18, rises just a little to 2770 in 2019, higher in 2883 in 2020, and finally in March of 2021, 3032 home closings. Well, we turn the page. Next, we find in this week's journal on retail and restaurants. And most of these are about food, so if you're hungry, you may want to grab a snack before you continue listening. Under the heading of expansion comes the article Cape Fear to Open in Village. The latest addition to a North Carolina seafood chain is open in Raleigh. The new location for Cape Fear Seafood Company at the Village District, formerly Cameron Village, opened at 2018 Clark Avenue on April 19th. It will stand out from other locations in the franchise because it's in the center of a bustling retail center, franchise partner Eddie Elliott says. This is the best location that the company has ever been a part of, he says. This area is a Raleigh institution, so this space will help the whole brand in North Carolina. Elliott and partner Matt Wivel opened first Raleigh location for the Wilmington-based company on Spring Forest Road in June of 2019. It's a great location, but it's more of a destination, Elliott says. Everyone has to drive only to see us. But at the Village District, there's already so many people around. The restaurant will feature the same menu with fresh fish, steaks, calabash-style fried platter, steamed shrimp, crab legs, scallops, and more. Elliott and Wavell announced the expansion in October and moved forward, deciding on the 3,500-square-foot space, after overcoming challenges due to the pandemic at their other Raleigh location. Last March, they closed the other Raleigh location when business restrictions went into effect for bars and restaurants. They temporarily cut their staff, offered a limited menu, and took over for about 2 weeks, Elliott says. Like everyone else, we took it one day at a time, he says. We went from about 55 people to 2 people. We did the dishes, cooked, served, and answered the phones until we could start bringing people back to help us. We slowly ramped up from there and reopened. It took a lot of patience and faith. The Village District location brings about 45 to 50 jobs, and the indoor and outdoor space holds a total of about 130 people. Entrepreneur Evan Trawick opened Cape Fear Seafood Company in 2008 in Wilmington, where there are now three restaurants. And a couple of pretty short articles here. Also in the food vein, under the heading of More Room, comes the article, Raleigh Pie Shop Expands from Pop-Up Space. A Raleigh-based bakery is leaving its downtown pop-up shop for a bigger facility that will allow for easier access to its award-winning pies. Slice Pie Company is leaving the space at 17 East Martin Street, where the pies have been sold, to fully transition to its location at 1400 South Saunders Street. The building near Summit Avenue is a little more than 2,000 square feet and will allow the family-owned business to have its retail and production under one roof for the first time, owner Kristen Mullins says. And the location has parking and more pickup options than the off-site shop, she adds. Soft opening is planned for June 1st. Mullins and her father, Michael Mullins, a longtime baker, started Slice Pie Company in 2014. The company now has a thriving wholesale business and recently partnered with Goldbelly, an online platform that provides nationwide delivery options. Our goal is to be a staple in Raleigh, she says. When we were looking for locations, we felt like that area on South Saunders Street. We get the most foot traffic and be easily accessible for customers who come from out of town. When Mullins was growing up, her dad inspired her to start baking after he won a blue ribbon for his apple pie and biscuits at the North Carolina State Fair. She started preparing and giving away apple pies before doing market research and turning her passion into a business. The company quickly grew in popularity without advertisement and got the title of Best Pies in North Carolina from several media outlets. The pie recipe features a flaky, vegan-friendly pie crust that tastes like a crunchy biscuit, Mullins said. I had no idea that people did not understand how to make or what a good pie is, she said. I thought about how nobody was making them like this, especially in this area. The company opened the pop-up shop downtown in 2019 with a six-month lease, which was renewed after the retail operations were successful. Now, finally, a non-food article here on the retail and restaurants page. Chicago-based is the heading. The article, National Real Estate Lender Launches Raleigh Office. One of the country's largest residential real estate lending companies, Renovo Financial, has expanded to the Triangle. The Chicago-based company offers loan programs for single-family and multifamily rehabilitation, new construction, and rental properties, in addition to in-house underwriting and servicing. Renovo says it's set to reach $1 billion in loans by the second quarter. The company has grown because of a focus on servicing people, its local market expertise, and providing financial resources, says Vice President of Lending Scott Anspach, who heads Triangle Operations. It chose the Triangle because of the ongoing high demand for homes, he says. Well, next we arrive at this week's cover story in the Triangle Business Journal, and this one's going to be a very difficult article to provide all the data for. There's a whole lot of data here and breakdowns by county. The whole thing is entitled Economic Sweet Spots. And the subheading is North Carolina's Pipeline of Jobs Looks Promising as 2021 Unfolds. And so there are about 40 different companies that are listed here. And they're listed in a breakdown by county. So here's a closer look at the 37 companies that have announced jobs in North Carolina since 2020. And they are sorted by county. So I'll read the county and the name of the company. In Cabarrus County, Golden Home International and Prime Beverage Group. In Cumberland, Danson's U.S. In Edgecombe, the Sara Lee Frozen Bakery. In Alamance, Chick-fil-A Supply. In Buncombe, Pratt & Whitney. In Burke, Unix Packaging. In Catawba, Merchants Distributors and American Fuji Seal. In Cleveland, Benistar Brands. In Guilford, in Alamance, Prepack Manufacturing Limited, and UPS. In Johnston, Griffles. In Durham, Bioagilytics, Eli Lilly, Grail, and Beam Therapeutics, as well as Adverum Biotechnologies. Also in Durham, Taysha Gene Therapies, The Clorox Company, Nuvotronics, in Lenore, Crown Equipment Company, in Lee, the Abzina Holdings, Audentis Therapeutics, in Mecklenburg, Centene Corporation, Intercontinental Capital Group, Robin Hood Markets, and in Mecklenburg, Retirement Clearinghouse, in Rockingham, the Ontex Group, and Nestle Purina Pet Care, and Farmina Pet Food USA, and Rowan, Eastern Wholesale Fence, in Pitt, Grover Gaming, and finally in Wake. The companies are Bandwidth, PennyMac Financial Services, Gilead Sciences, and Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies. Now, let's take a look at the prose of this article, now that I've given you a whirlwind tour of the data. The winds kept coming from his home office miles away from the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina's headquarters. The state's chief business recruiter, Christopher Chung, was watching them pour in remotely. In the span of one day in March, Google unveiled a major cloud engineering hub in Durham, one that can mean 1,000 jobs, and Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies, which had been courting incentives in both Texas and the Tar Heel State, picked Holly Springs for its 725-job manufacturing facility after a months-long search. And on the computer screen in front of him, Chung was eyeing even more opportunities. A pipeline that, as of April 5th, contained the names of 191 companies considering recruitment and expansion products in the state. If North Carolina were to win them all, it would mean the potential for 63,000 new jobs, $22 billion in new investment. North Carolina, Chung knew, was in an enviable position, nearly the opposite of what some had feared a year ago when the pandemic was starting to rage and site selection consultants feared a long pause could be coming, a pause that ended up being a hiccup. "We're in a Goldilocks moment," Chung says now, echoing a term multiple economic developers, real estate professionals, and executives have used to describe the state in recent weeks. The sweet spot for economic growth. Demand is going to come back because people are less concerned about the health ramifications. They've been vaccinated. They're getting vaccinated. But it's not just the vaccines that have companies eyeing the state in 2021. It's not just the talent pool or the intersecting hubs for tech and life sciences in the Triangle, or even the low cost of living and working. It's all of it, a perfect harmony of factors lining up at the most opportune time. And it's the fact that it's happening as, on the other side, a perfect storm is swirling in dense areas like San Francisco and New York, where, amid a pandemic, the crowds suddenly aren't what they used to be. And the political ramifications of the controversial voting law are starting to hit Atlanta, one of the Triangle's biggest competitors in the Southeast. It's adding up to opportunity, Chung says, and his team is raking it in. A report out of EDPNC showed that 2020 netted nearly 147 new corporate location and expansion deals, expected to create a combined 20,000 jobs. And there's been a rise in large projects, in particular, the data show. Since 2019, North Carolina officials have announced 71 incentivized projects, each bringing 100 or more jobs. In 2019, those projects totaling more than 11,800 jobs were announced. In 2020, even amid a pandemic, the number swelled to nearly 12,400. And already in 2021, seven firms have each announced plans to bring more than 100 jobs to the state in exchange for incentives. And that could mean more than 2,300 jobs, including Abzina Holdings, which announced April 13 that it would bring 325 jobs to Lee County over competing sites in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Philadelphia, and San Diego. Quiet. That's how economic developers and site selection consultants described in late March and April of 2020 in North Carolina and beyond. A pandemic was creeping into the public's attention. Shutdowns were being implemented. And while some long-planned projects popped, Bandwidth's decision to invest in a Raleigh headquarters helped ease some worries about economic development. Most hit the pause button. Economic developers were nervous. They were waiting to see how the situation played out, Chung says. Site visits turned into Zoom calls. Zoom calls required more due diligence. Some site selection searches were extended. Others, particularly those coming from across the ocean, halted altogether amid travel restrictions. And for weeks, no one knew when the next blockbuster project would be coming. With work from home becoming the new normal, some worried that some site selection would stop altogether in favor of remote teams. Would EDP&C have to adapt to a complete strategy shift? Chung asked himself at the time. Would economic developers need to work out ways to incentivize remote workers instead of the companies that employ them? Gradually, the calls picked up again. Consultants got in cars instead of planes. Economic developers worked on creative solutions. They took videos of sites with drones. They put tables outside, 6 feet apart, and they kept the conversations going. Then, with the advent of the vaccine, those car trips turned into air travel again. Gradually, some site selection visits began to look almost normal. And the worst-case scenario that seemed so close a year ago never materialized. The opposite started to happen, a boost few had expected. As executives at expanding and relocating companies kick-started the searches, so too did companies boosted by the pandemic itself. Take Berry Group, a nonwoven textile manufacturer out of Indiana with multiple sites in North Carolina. Among its product set are the disinfecting wipes that, even pre-pandemic, were seeing an increase in demand. With the onset of COVID-19, product shortages made headlines. So, Berry embarked on its own site selection search, analyzing its footprint for places where it could add to its manufacturing lines. On April the 12th, it picked the Johnston County community of Benson for a 70-job expansion over competing sites in areas such as Ohio. Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director for Johnston County, says that, as usual, access to talent was a big part of the decision. Talent was the reason Fujifilm ended up picking Holly Springs for its massive manufacturing line. It was the reason Fidelity Investments gave in announcing a more than 200-job expansion in Durham on April the 9th. And it was the reason Google gave when announcing its project in Durham. But talent's always been a big selling point for North Carolina. What's changed in 2021 is a sudden awareness of density in places such as New York and San Francisco. In the age of social distancing, the crowded city that just a year ago seemed so dynamic has suddenly a liability both to physical health and business health. Jim Diffley, Executive Director for Economics at IHS Market, says North Carolina has been building its economic prowess for years, putting it in prime position to take advantage of those trends. The pandemic is layered into what has been, to me, a very optimistic outlook for North Carolina, he says, pointing to in-migration trends from places like New York that existed before 2020. 2020 just expedited what had been happening for some time. Many executives and employees already had North Carolina, and particularly the Triangle, on their radars. And the realization that they were paying thousands of dollars for tiny apartments and working remotely anyway made them question the value proposition of their situations. Places like Raleigh stand a fair better in that dynamic than other places. Relative to other tech centers, home prices are still reasonable, Diffley says, although they're rising very fast, and that could become an issue going forward. Paul Zarian, director at real estate giant Hines, agrees. No question about it, he says. It's a cost issue. And as people have thought about it, they say, okay, I have the ability to work from anywhere. Why am I paying $4,000 for an apartment and exorbitant tax rates? North Carolina is really benefiting from a Goldilocks convergence of factors, where it has reasonable cost of living, great weather, and the talent here already. Another Triangle advantage is diversity. Brooks Forbes, CIO and head of technology for personal investing at Fidelity, says her firm is focused on diversity as a priority going forward, and that it played into its decision to announce its 225-job expansion in Durham. We're a company that's focused on that for our clients and certainly focused on that for our associates, she says. With the events of 2020, Fidelity isn't alone. Multiple big-name companies, including Fortune 500 players, have renewed their commitments to diversity, potentially putting more of a premium on diverse talent pools, such as what the Triangle can offer. And the companies that are seeing successes amid COVID-19 and are in the financial position where an expansion is not just feasible, but a necessary growth play, tend to be in areas where the Triangle can already compete, putting the region in even more of a prime spot, says Ted Abernathy, managing partner at Economic Leadership. Technology, fintech, and biopharma are really the hot marketplaces right now, and we're really good at all of those, he says. Zarian says North Carolina is in the enviable position of being a place where people move to, even before they find a job. Simply put, North Carolina is a place where people want to live, he says. Ultimately, in many of these companies' minds, talent is the main driver of their location decisions. Couple those new opportunities with the pent-up demand from firms who had been looking pre-pandemic, and economic developers see that Goldilocks story translating to a big 2021 for North Carolina, and the successes could keep coming. Abernathy says there are several factors that add up to major recovery potential. He says savings rates are high, meaning there's more than $1.5 trillion in excess savings that people across the nation could spend, further boosting business recovery. It's a situation beyond what most had dared to imagine a year ago, Abernathy says. The intricacies of the pandemic's impact on the innovation economy were just hard to predict, starting with the fact that remote workers actually turned out to be pretty productive. I don't think we were expecting that. We were expecting a disruption, he says. And as Chung is hearing from some prospects, even with the success of remote work, many technology firms are still clamoring for a return to the office. While it remains to be seen how the work-from-home trend will impact office footprints overall, for now at least, it's not disrupting the pace of the economic development wins. What hasn't returned, however, is international demand. We're still down quite a bit from our normal level of FDI in the pipeline, Chung says, noting ongoing travel restrictions have had an impact. While it's something economic developers are watching closely, there are signals that foreign interest, too, is coming back. Case in point, a foreign company in the biotech space that economic developers have been talking to for years without success may soon pull the trigger on a North Carolina expansion. While Chung won't identify the firm, he says the state's success in life sciences has captured its attention. Over the past year, you look at how many wins we've had. They've taken notice, and it's made them a lot more receptive, he says. The same can be said across sectors, Zarian says. Once you see those large employers move in, he says, that can then create a domino effect. Others are noticing. The state was named 2020 State of the Year by Business Facilities Magazine. That's the first time North Carolina earned the magazine's top honor. But even those rankings show heavy competition. Texas, for example, topped North Carolina in the magazine's Best Business Climate, followed by Virginia, Tennessee, Alabama, and then North Carolina. Texas, which landed the massive Tesla Gigafactory last year, is seeing a particular influx from California, and its proximity to those fleeing San Francisco is hard to beat. Texas-based real estate developer Ari Rastigar says Texas will keep winning the mega projects, even as North Carolina will stay competitive due to affordability. He says it comes down to dollars. If they're looking at incentives and money, Texas will blow it out of the water, Rastigar says. But North Carolina's recruiters remain confident in the state's high appeal. And Chung says economic developers are working to leverage each announcement for the next one. Every single one of these wins just sends that much more of a signal to the industry that North Carolina is the place to be. Well, we finished the cover story, so let's turn to Executive Voice. And this week's Executive Voice belongs to Jess Jolly, a nonprofit leader, a startup founder, and now a changemaker at fast-growing Raleigh software firm Pendo. Meet Jess Jolly, hired last year as Pendo's first director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Jolly joined the firm at a pivotal time for the company and the nation. Pendo is in the midst of its pledge to create 590 new jobs in downtown Raleigh, and the nation is on the cusp of a reckoning after the racially charged events of last year. As I think about 2020, it really caused and brought attention to a lot of the challenges that were happening prior to this year as it relates to race, as it relates to general equity, she says. It really put a spotlight on diversity, equity, and inclusion in a way. A lot of people have been working in the space, but we had national attention over the summer. Suddenly, people had no choice but to pay attention, and that included Pendo, whose leaders had always tried to be empathetic and aware, she says. Over the summer, they tried to think inwardly on pieces of the puzzle they could control, how bias shows up in the workplace, how minority communities are underrepresented in the tech space, and Jolly was hired to help Pendo develop a strategy for the future. At Pendo, what can we do to make sure we're strategic, she explains. How do we provide those opportunities? How do we build the right opportunities? How are we sourcing strategically to find candidates that maybe didn't have the traditional experiences we think of when we think about tech? For Jolly, it's a dream role for a woman who grew up on a tobacco farm in rural North Carolina, attended the North Carolina School of Science and Math, and then earned her bachelor's degree from UNC Chapel Hill as a Morehead Cain Scholar. Jolly still recalls her first job, where she was the only woman on the team. I didn't fit in, she said. I was nervous about speaking up. I didn't feel like I could be myself at work. Then a mentor began to push, saying, "You are qualified to be here. You deserve to be here. You interview just like everyone else." Something snapped, Jolly recalls. Just having that confidence, it changed everything. I felt like I could come into a room, give my perspective. It just felt so different. And that's what really made me say that I wanted to do this work. And it has driven her career. At Deloitte, she launched the Communities of Color Affinity Group as a volunteer project. The group, which focused on retaining diverse talent, supported more than 400 women of color through education and training, community building, and mentorship. That led to a consulting project to create My Brother's Keeper Alliance, an initiative of the Obama Foundation, on a mission to address opportunity gaps facing boys and young men of color. Jolly helped found consulting firm Generation Titans, eventually spinning out a community and crowdfunding platform called Reunion to connect Black, Latinx, and Indigenous founders to resources. At Pendo, she's leading the charge to find talent in places where, a few years ago, the tech firms might not have been looking, from community partners to historically Black colleges and universities. Jolly says it goes beyond sourcing the actual talent. She says firms such as Pendo need to train hiring managers to look for the value add in differences. Jolly says it helps to talk about the benefits of diversity. To drive change, you need diversity of thought. As a product company, she says it's essential to think about all the people you're building your product for, and that without diverse voices, you could be missing something key. You need diversity of experience, diversity of background, she says. This year's really brought awareness to that. For companies looking to start diversity initiatives, be patient and strategic, Jolly says. It takes time. You have to be strategic. You have to be thoughtful. You have to measure and hold yourself accountable. The first step in starting a D&I initiative is listening, Jolly says. Make sure that you're thinking about what voices are in that conversation. So if you're talking about how do we make sure we have greater gender diversity, are the people you're talking about, are they actually having a seat at the table, she says? At Pendo, having strong employee resource groups to start those conversations is essential, Jolly says. Pendo has employee-led groups meeting quarterly with its executive team, and it's making an effort to be transparent about its diversity data, she adds. We have internal dashboards. We are in executive meetings asking, how are we doing, she says. Jolly, like others who have joined Triangle companies in the age of remote working, finds the biggest challenge is networking, building a community virtually. Her advice? To follow different community managers on social media and just try to meet as many people as possible. As we near the end of the broadcast, we turn to the last page of Triangle Business Journal and we find the editor's notebook. And that article this week is entitled, Be Careful When Dealing with High-Flying SPACs, or SPACs. almost like clockwork. Smart people always figure out a way to make money on Wall Street, something that always tips the investment scale toward the person who invented the idea. By now, everyone knows about SPACs, short for Special Purpose Acquisition Companies. These SPACs raise money from all kinds of rich and financial speculators, then register to trade on public exchanges as a shell enterprise. They have no operations, no balance sheet, only gobs of money. They have about 2 years to buy a private company, which then automatically becomes a public enterprise. Under the current scenario, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission plays a minimal role in the SPAC itself going public. But after the merger, the public company has to abide by the same rules as any company trading on exchanges. So why is it necessary for companies to go public through SPACs when the U.S. already has a system in place, that's IPOs, to take companies public? SPAC proponents say this saves private companies tons of money in the front end because the IPO process is costly. Technically, that's true, but that's not the whole story. The biggest loophole that SPACs are taking advantage of is the fact that by bypassing the IPO process, these companies are also avoiding the SEC vetting process. So for a retail investor, there's no way to really know the financial condition of the private company that's gobbled up by the shell. We are trusting the managers of the SPAC with that. It's dangerous, and one faulty and unscrupulous SPAC can bring the whole system down, costing retail investors billions of dollars. Less than 4 months into 2021, SPAC activity has already surpassed 2020 numbers. There have been more than 275 SPAC offerings to date, raising more than $100 billion. About the same time last year, there were about 80 traditional IPOs, and they raised about $33 billion during the same time. It's time for the SEC to start being serious about looking at these SPACs to make sure the retail investors don't get hurt down the road. Governance and transparency is somewhat lacking with these instruments, admits Dale Folwell, North Carolina State Treasurer. I think the market operating at 0% interest rates is playing a big role. I've never seen this kind of money poured into a trendy investment in my 30-plus years. Truthfully, shell companies have been with us for more than 10 years, but in the past 18 months, there must have been a reason for this euphoria taking shape. Was it the interest rates? Was it to purposely create a bubble in the name of efficiency? Or was it something else? If there are this many private companies being gobbled up by SPACs to go public, why were they not interested in going public through the IPO process? It can't be just the cost of the IPO process, especially when these companies are showing hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. In order to protect investors, U.S. securities regulators need to step up scrutiny of these SPACs. Think about it. In the IPO process, there's a company that's chasing money so it can go public. In the SPAC process, there are billions of dollars chasing private companies to take public. We need different rules and regulations for what's becoming the richest trend for financiers endorsed by celebrities and Wall Street. And if we fail, we may fall back to the days of Michael Milken, Enron, and Ivan Boesky. This week's guest editorial on the Viewpoint page is written by John Merrick. Merrick is executive director of the Anson Economic Development Partnership, and his article is entitled Rural Communities Need Product, Not Handouts. Industrial buildings and sites are the ante that allows communities to get into the site selection game. Without them, workforce, airports, highways, railroads, and universities are little more than words on a marketing flyer. Rural communities across North Carolina are especially aware of the importance of available industrial product on their ability to compete for jobs and investment. Metro areas often have private real estate developers vying with each other to construct speculative buildings, or partnering with local government on such projects. Rural communities, such as Anson County, even though we're just 40 miles from Charlotte, are typically left to our own devices. Private developers ultimately seek to maximize return, not help a struggling county. While understandable, it illustrates the difficulty rural communities face when competing with metro areas for economic investment. There are well-intentioned state programs designed to level the recruitment playing field, but they require a bird in hand and a ready client with defined expansion or relocation specifications. The state prohibits the use of funds on speculative buildings. Rural Economic Developers are not looking for a handout. We're simply seeking a way to remain competitive in a booming commercial real estate market that's skewed against us. In some cases, companies locate in the metro area for proximity to suppliers or customers, easy access to an international airport or interstate, or specialized workforce requirements. But many deals go to metro areas simply because they have the available buildings that their rural counterparts lack. Fortunately, there's a simple market-oriented solution to improving rural competitiveness that does not require the state to dive headlong into the commercial development business. Revolving loan funds are a proven tool for assisting communities in the development of speculative product. A 10-year, zero-interest loan is a low-cost, low-risk way for the state to kickstart commercial development projects in rural areas where other forms of funding cannot be accessed. With appropriate rules and qualifications, a loan fund covering up to 90% of the cost of spec building construction would put such a building within reach of most rural counties while ensuring local leaders maintain some skin in the game and are raising a speculative building, not a fantasy building. The 10-year maturity period would allow communities with successful projects to turn that money two or more times. In contrast, communities that plan or execute poorly will appropriately receive a more limited return. Making progress on rural product development is a key legislative priority of the North Carolina Economic Development Association, which is now making its case to the General Assembly to craft bold, creative solutions for assessing this persistent obstacle to job growth and business recruitment in rural communities. U.S. trade and social policies the past 30 years have had a devastating impact on rural North Carolina, while bolstering the economies of more densely populated areas. It's time for Raleigh to reverse that trend and distribute some of the fruits of the state's unprecedented prosperity back into the counties that were once the backbone of our economy. Rural communities aren't looking for a gift. We just want a fighting chance. Well, that music means that we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anjou. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have questions, call us, 919-832-5138. So long till next time.